The original shimmering self gets buried so deep, most of us end up hardly living out of it at all. That's a quote from Christian theologian Frederick Buechner, and an idea that I have been wrestling with this week. Where is that shimmering self? What happens to diminish its expression? And most importantly, how do we live out of more of it now? As I was mulling over that question about the regular, everyday kinds of things that color and change how we relate to life, a vague image popped into my head. A photograph of a large beach chair containing a child. The beach chair is covered with towels, so much so that the only way you know there is a child underneath is from the feet poking out at the bottom, and the fact that you happen to know the story behind the photo, which I do, and you will soon too. Flashback a few decades ago, and there I was, maybe 10 or 11, an hour or two before that photo was taken, ignoring the calls to come downstairs, have breakfast, and go to the beach. I didn't want to go. I had the covers pulled over my head, a special Dutch comic book in my hands, and a stack more within arm's reach. I had created a comfortable little world, and I was absorbed in the stories. I felt cozy and safe, and I did not want to go to the beach. It was day two of a vacation at my cousin's house near the ocean in the Netherlands. We would visit there regularly before we moved away from Holland, and about once a year after that. Childhood times with my cousins and siblings stand out in my memory, biking with a gaggle of us on the cobbled streets, one pedaling, another on the rack in the back, hanging on for dear life. Or adventures of made-up scavenger hunts, or going to the beach together and coming home after hours, sunburnt, tired, and satisfied. I was one of the youngest. I looked up to them, and whatever we did was full of life and color in my memory. I don't think it mattered much to me what we did. But this time, when my family drove up to begin our holiday the day before, the house was empty. Their family had gone somewhere else for their vacation, and we got to borrow the house. A totally sensible arrangement and a great thing to do from my parents' perspective, to switch places with another family for a week at the beach, but for my 11-year-old self, it just wasn't the same without them there. The rooms in their house didn't look the same, the street didn't feel the same, and the idea of going to the beach without them, it just didn't feel right. And in my 11-year-old, short-sighted disappointment, I wanted to curl up, be left to myself, alone. And in my 11-year-old budding inclination to resist doing things I didn't want to do, I tried just saying no. And, well, that didn't work. I was, after all, only 11, and the family would be going to the beach, and I would be going with them. That was made quite clear. And so we went. And this is a long story, but the point is coming, so bear with me. Upon arrival at the beach, not to be deterred, I found myself a beach chair with one of those little overhangs at the top. I pulled a bunch of towels out of my family's beach bag and hung them off the front and the side, grabbed my comic books, and did my best to recreate the soothing little haven I had made with my blankets that morning. In doing so, I managed to block out everything around me. The waves, the color of the sky, the breeze, my siblings playing in the sand, my parents, who were probably wondering what was going on. Well, before they decided to take a photo to memorialize this unusual moment. It's only now, looking back, that I realize I was experiencing a confusing mix of things. I was feeling deflated, disappointed, powerless, resentful. Feelings I did not know how to talk about, did not know how to move through. And not knowing how to reconnect with that wholehearted, big-spirited, full-color adventurousness I had experienced when my cousins were there, I instead created, with a handful of towels and my comic books, a wan, half-hearted stand-in. I have since found more sophisticated ways to block out realities that I don't like. But I have found that when I do that, it's just as limiting my experience, just as lukewarm. Which is one reason I love that poem from Mary Oliver, "So Not Lukewarm." When you hear, she writes, a mile away and still out of sight, the churn of the water fretting around sharp rocks, its danger, its adventure, freedom, passion. In a different poem, Oliver beseeches us, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? We lose touch with our passion. It gets buried in a world full of ways to block out reality, whether that's Netflix or shopping or alcohol, whether that's gambling, TV, or Dutch comic books. Our world is full of lukewarm replacements for wholehearted engagement and full of messages rationalizing these things and rationalizing why your life in particular just is the way it is. We tangle with messages every day that say we can't, we're not good enough, it doesn't matter, you're only one person, your artwork's no good, you can't sing, please don't try. You're not talented enough or smart enough or clever enough, you can't do it and you don't have the time anyway. 1,000 deflating messages are floating around inside our heads that can leave us feeling small and tame and believing that we can't. It's just about enough to keep a person from stepping into that rowboat at all. Just keeping the status quo, keeping the same as the same. We don't even always know we've lost touch with something bigger until we actually start to move. That's when we notice something's been off. We've been numb. We feel pins and needles as we take action. Internal voices get more active and noisy. No, you really can't do it. No, you're really not capable. No, you really don't have the time. The more we defy limiting messages, frequently the louder they get. I'm reminded of that movie, The Truman Show. Maybe you remember that one. The lead actor is living in a well-to-do suburb with manicured lawns and happy children riding around on bikes. It's a picture-perfect, comfortable life. Only he comes to find out that, in fact, the whole thing was manufactured. The whole scene was created as a part of a reality TV set. As the movie develops, the lead starts to get suspicious that something is off. He starts asking tough questions and pushing the envelope. Finally, he escapes in a boat and sails right smack into the edge of the giant bubble they have locked him into, finds a set of stairs, and sees a doorway out. In the closing scene, as our hero finally gets ready to leave, gets ready to explore the real world, the voice of the show's creator comes on over the intercom. He tries to stop him. With one compelling argument after another, he tries to persuade Truman not to leave his limited reality. "You're afraid," he says. "You like it here. You don't want to leave." "The lies out there," he says, "are as bad as the lies in here, but in here, at least, you're safe." The messages we hear, the stories we're told, the lines we tell ourselves may keep us safe or feel like they do, but what are we missing? In a sermon delivered in 2008, Reverend Marlon Lavenhar touched on this, how the stories we're told about things growing up sound good, but are sometimes misleading. In his Chicago suburb in the 70s, he said he was taught simply about America being the greatest country in the world, the land of freedom for all and equal opportunity, the land where Europeans and Native Americans feasted together and built a righteous nation. But at some stage, he writes, most of us figure out that the history we're taught is not the full story, and in some cases, not even the real story. And when our young selves hit that greater complexity, I would add, when we face the disappointment of some greater truth, what do we make of it? And what do we do with it? When we begin to see and understand something about racism, slavery, genocide, war, when we begin to realize that not every adult has our best interests in mind and not everyone is to be trusted. There are so many things about which we could feel dismayed, frightened, and heartbroken, and there was probably a time when we could really feel it. Whether we can now or whether it's blocked, that heartbreak is, I believe, still with us. And a religious community, I quote Marlon Lavenhar again, knows something about broken hearts and about standing up, shows us how to take our heartbreak and transform it into a sacred fire for change. A fire that opens us and heals our world. We do not have to stay small. We do not have to buy into discouragement. We do not have to believe any limiting stories we've been told. We are living in big times, critical times, times that are calling us out of ourselves, times that are shaking us up and pushing us forward. Although Reverend Lavenhar was writing nearly 10 years ago, his words still ring true. This is a time of conflict and terror, he writes, a time when growing extremism is dividing the human family, a time in which the environment is in serious danger. At times like this, he continues, we need passionate, free-thinking people and institutions willing to take stands that will give birth to a new era. An era in which religion becomes a source of peace and unity, not division and oppression. An era in which we will not rest until our rivers are clean, until our schools are adequate, until all our children and elderly have access to adequate health care, until the color of a person's skin is no more social or economic significant than the color of their hair or their eyes. It's going to take a new kind of leadership like we've never seen before. It's going to take leaders who know where their hearts have been broken and know how to help the rest of us turn our passion into compassion and anger into a transforming fire. 10 years ago, still much too true today. The world is full of heartbreak, small ones and big ones, ones we faced alone, ones we carry together. We can't go back and change what happened, but we can change what happens next. In The Truman Show, the hero, after pausing to listen to that voice who said, "Stop, don't do it, you're safer right here," that hero did, in the end, step through the door into real life toward the unknown, answering some deeper call. And when I think of that story about me with that beach chair and those towels, the most important to me now is not that I tried to block my discomfort or ways I've done that too much in my life. What stands out to me now is the way I experienced myself with that gaggle of siblings and cousins, that full-throttled, big-hearted spirit that those times brought out in me, because that is always mine. Whether they're with me or not, I've discovered that when I jump in, when I embrace the churn and swirl and roil, when I commit to something that's bigger than me and connects me to others, I get some of that back. I get more people back. I get more of myself back. I reconnect with passion. And while there are things we as individuals cannot change in this big, wide, crazy world of ours, there are also things we can. More than we know, more than we often believe, things in our lives, in our communities, in our world. There are people in this congregation working on all kinds of issues that matter through all kinds of committees and task forces and teams. How good to be in this together. So, living with passion in two parts this month. Part one from last week, lay the groundwork, join a connection group, build relationships, create a place to land. And part two from today, take action, meet resistance, don't be fooled, just keep going. Resist, rest, repeat. Connect, act, reflect. Join in, jump in, find joy. And as we do, may we find that the passion we never lost grows stronger in us every day. May it be so.